Radical love, lavish generosity, extravagant forgiveness, inclusive hospitality, compassionate action, selfless service, a passion for justice, creative nonviolence, simple living. Good day, good people. I'm Robert Farrell. This is Coalesce. Thank you for joining me. Coalesce is grounded in both and thinking, heart wisdom, and listening for the common good arising in dialogue, where we are present to presence. Coalesce provides an opportunity to encounter and discover the multiple perspectives that make our beautiful community. May we see with the eyes of our heart. May we love one another with peace and compassion. May all beings come to know the divine presence within. This is episode 40, Wisdom of Imaginarium. Another building block in the wisdom lineage is the world of myth, art, and poetry. This realm has a great capacity to bring coherence, meaning, healing, connection, and deep trust for the human journey that's really demanded of us. Jane Hershiel's words, "A good poem makes nothing happen. It solves no outer problem. It is inherently contemplative." And that's why myth, poetry, and art heal. Rather than orient you toward solving a problem, they turn your focus toward your naked being itself, that deeper level of meaning, purpose, and inner vitality, that deep well from which we draw our enduring energies. They evoke those levels hidden beneath the steel manhole cover of the ego, and speak to our personal unconsciousness as good therapy does, and even the collective unconscious as mystical and unitive knowing does. Not all truths are created equal or of equal importance. Something might be true, for example, merely on a psychological level, or a historical level, or a mythological level, but not on a universal level. For some sad and illogical reason, fundamentalists think that the historical level is the truest one. Did it really happen just that way? The literal level is one of the least fruitful levels of meaning. Even if it did happen just that way, our capacity to understand even that truth is still filtered through our own cultural and personal biases, which are largely unconscious. Truth on that level may be fascinating, but it seldom changes your life. The difference between logos and mythos. Logos, which is more like problem-solving language, and mythos, which is more like the language used in good poetry. Logos language includes facts, data, evidence, and precise descriptions. Logos language and thinking got us medicine, got us airplanes. We are living in a culture in which we have had for the past 300 years an explosion of logos language. But the problem is there are whole dimensions of our existence that require a different way of thinking. The Bible is mostly written in mythos language. Good religion traffics in mythos. Mythos language is for that which is more than literally true. Evolutionary science, which is logos language, does an excellent job of explaining why I don't have a tail. It just doesn't do so well explaining why I find that interesting. We need mythos language to express the more than factual meaning of experiences, like falling in love, loss, and death. Good religion, art, poetry, and myth point us to the deeper levels of truth that logos can't fully explain. Even Christians knew this. But the Western Church spent the last 5 centuries trying to prove that the myths and stories in the Bible really happened historically, just as they are described. The Church went backward here, as we came to rely heavily on technique, formula, and certitude instead of the alluring power of trust and allowing. The whole point of Scripture is the transformation of the soul. But when we stopped understanding myth, we stopped understanding how to read and profit from sacred story. Art, myth, and poetry invite us into the transformative world of sacred story. This kind of knowing has the power to change us at the level of the subconscious and intuition because it can open mind, heart, and body simultaneously. Children can read stories over and over again, fully fascinated, without needing to verify the historical question. Thus, they can live eternal and always true time, given away by the lovely and captivating opening phrase, "Once upon a time." Wisdom, just like good poetry, must and will always resist intelligence. It gives just enough of reality to keep us out of our too easy egoistic center. True wisdom requires a spiritual state to complete the logic. Mature spirituality insists that we hold out for meaning instead of settling for mere answers. Wisdom is necessarily and always partially hidden, and reveals herself only to those who really want her and will not try to make a commodity of her. See Wisdom 6, verses 12 through 22, and Wisdom 7, verses 22 through Wisdom 8, verse 8. You cannot even imagine something or do something until you first have an image of it. This is surely why Einstein said imagination is more important than intelligence. We each have constructed our own imaginarium of inner symbols, meanings, archetypes, and memories that have formed us. This is almost entirely unconscious, but visibly operative in all our choices and preferences. The imaginarium is foundationally real for us, and has very concrete effects. All the logic and reason in the world cannot change us unless we allow that logic to change our inner symbolic universe. You can observe the deep power of the imaginarium when you try to change a person's deep sexual fascinations or their need for security or certitude. Christians were probably right when we said that only God can do this, by rearranging our inner symbolic world. Such transformation might be called radical conversion, and it is somewhat uncommon. Let me give a strong example. For many Christians, the very word Mary evokes an entire imaginarium in the soul, and from there does its very good work. If you have no Mary imaginarium, Mary probably cannot save you. All of the Marys in the Gospels, we are not even sure how many there are, but they exercise a transformative bridal mysticism on the prepared human psyche. They feminize, sweeten, and give eros and pathos to the spiritual journey. They work on you in 100 unconscious ways, according to how, when, why, and with what readiness we read the text or look at the image. Metaphor means that which carries you across. In a heart open to the power of metaphor, that which carries you across, is a heart open to the feminine and open to intimacy, and it will leap every time. A heart trapped in historical literalism or closed to the power of poetry will remain bored, reactive, and trapped in critique. A true symbol is not only a pointer to a more absolute reality, but by that very fact awakens us to the deepest level of our own life too. Good symbolism and imagery moves us into contact with our true self, with others, and with everything, God. After radical conversion, after you have once fallen through the ego and into the collective unconscious, the whole world starts becoming symbolic. Both Carl Jung and Joseph Campbell spent much of their lives trying to unpack these archetypal symbols for Western linear people. Thomas Merton even says, "One cannot apprehend a symbol unless one is able to awaken in one's own being the spiritual resonances which respond to the symbol not only as a sign but as a sacrament and presence." The symbol is an object pointing to a subject. We are summoned to a deeper spiritual awareness far beyond the level of subject and object. And we call that unitive or non-dual consciousness. Mythologies and religions are great poems, and when recognized as such, point infallibly through things and events to the ubiquity of a presence or eternity that is whole and entire in each. In this function, all mythologies, all great poetries, and all mystic traditions are in accord, and where any such inspiriting vision remains effective in a civilization, everything and every creature within its range is alive. And I would add, this vision is trustworthy and has a message for the soul. When mythologies and religions are no longer effective, all transformation ceases, and you have a quickly declining culture with a high degree of mental illness and neurosis. We must ask ourselves, is this not our present situation? Let us take this moment to connect with that trustworthy vision and message for the soul. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. Western rationalization no longer understands myths and their importance. Although almost all historical cultures valued myths, we are the obvious exception. Western culture has replaced these effective and healing storylines with ineffective, cruel, and disorienting narratives like communism, fascism, terrorism, capitalism, and consumerism. Each in its own way is a watertight explanation and refuses any outside critique. Each human has a de facto worldview that determines what is important and what is not important to us, and we largely operate unconsciously until we are awakened from our sleep. Worldviews usually have a symbolic story to hold them together, such as that of Honest Abe chopping wood in Kentucky and educating himself in Illinois. Clever myths like this become a standing and effective metaphor for the American worldview of self-determination, hard work, and achievement. Whether they are exact historical truth is not even important. We want and need them to be true. And that is okay. Such myths proceed from the deep and collective unconscious of humanity. Our myths are stories or images that are not always true in particular, but entirely true in general. They are usually not historical fact, but invariably they are spiritual genius. They hold life and death, the explainable and the unexplainable together as one. They hold together the paradoxes that the rational mind cannot process by itself. Myths, as do good poems and art, make unclear and confused emotions brilliantly clear and even life-changing. Myths are true basically because they work. A sacred myth keeps a people healthy, happy, and whole, even inside their pain. They give deep meaning and pull us into deep time, which encompasses all time, past and future, geological and chronological, and not just our little time or culture. Such stories are the very food of the soul. When we start fairy tales with lines like long ago in a faraway land, we are reaching for deep time truth. Through all the ages of ages, we say. Somehow deep time orients the psyche, gives ultimate perspective, realigns us, grounds us, and thus heals us. We belong to a mystery far grander than our little selves and our little time. Great storytellers and spiritual teachers always know this. The postmodern world has rejected most myths except two, and these are especially lethal for the soul and for the poor and for the future. I produce, therefore I am, and I consume, therefore I am. This will never work for the soul, but we, believers and clergy included, have drunk this fairly new version of Kool-Aid. Remember, the opposite of rational is not necessarily irrational, but it can also be transrational, or bigger than the rational mind can process. Things like love, death, suffering, God, and infinity are transrational experiences. Both myth and mature religion understand this. The transrational has the capacity to keep us inside an open system and a larger horizon so that the soul, the heart, and the mind do not close down inside of small and suffering times. The merely rational mind is dualistic and divides the field of the moment between what it can presently understand and what it deems wrong or untrue. Because the rational mind cannot process love or suffering, for example, it tends to either avoid them, deny them, or blame somebody for them, when in fact they are the greatest spiritual teachers of all, if we will allow them. Our loss of mythic consciousness has not served the last few centuries well, and has overseen the growth of rigid fundamentalism in all the world religions. Now we get trapped in destructive and invisible myths because we do not have the eyes to see how the great healing myths like the Exodus, cross and resurrection, Krishna and Arjuna in the chariot, and Buddha under the Buddha tree function and transform. Clarissa Pinkola Estes says this, "I hope you will go out and let stories, that is life, happen to you, and that you will work with these stories. Water them with your blood and tears and your laughter till they bloom, till you yourself burst into bloom." Joseph Campbell writes, "Myths are clues to the spiritual potentialities of the human life. Mythology teaches you what's behind literature and the arts. It teaches you about your own life." I think of mythology as the homeland of the muses, the inspirers of art, the inspirers of poetry. To see life as a poem and yourself participating in a poem is what the myth does for you. Often various forms of wordless art and music precede the mythic story. We often know things imaginally, aesthetically, or harmoniously before we know them rationally or conceptually. As long as humans have existed, it seems that we've turned to art to express the inexpressible. Sacred art seeks to represent the invisible by means of the visible. Even in archaic and folk cultures, lacking any philosophical system and vocabulary, the function of sacred art was the same. It translated religious experience and a metaphysical conception of the world and of human existence into a concrete representational form. This translation was not considered wholly the work of man. The divinity also participated by revealing himself to man and allowing himself to be perceived in form or figure. Whenever we see an iconoclastic form of reformation, it is an angry regression and an overreacting constriction. It is not good news. Examples include 8th century Orthodoxy and most 16th century Protestants. This is not to say that both the Orthodox and the Catholics did not substitute lots of mass-produced Madonnas with cherubs and predictable icons for the kind of art that shouts, "You must change your life," as the poet Rainer Maria Rilke describes. We don't need a reason for art. Beauty is for beauty's sake. Art and music are not simply objects, but an experience of opening to mystical awareness. Perhaps the profound pleasure we sometimes experience from listening to Bach or Mozart is not a distraction from that process of attuning, nor even a side effect of it, but is that attuning? What is the non-dual experience if not such an attunement? Nor need that enjoyment be understood subjectively. If the whole of creation groans and travails in pain together, does it not also leap for joy together, in us, or rather as us? See Romans 8:22. The Franciscan formation includes daily, well-disciplined singing of magnificent Gregorian chants. People arrived early in the dark morning just to listen to the friars climb and descend the calm but pleasant scales of pure tonality. And then people left when they started with the wordy parts of the service. They had already received the healing message. It is a good and coherent world, and we are part of it. Let us take this moment to connect with the healing message. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. Robert Frost wrote that great poetry begins as a lump in the throat, a homesickness, a love sickness. Poetry stirs something you can't explain. When it comes, you just know that it is given out of nowhere. That's when you experience radical grace. Poets try to find the perfect word to name the inner experience. The goal of great poetry is to get right to the heart of the experience so that it resonates with your own inner knowing and you can say, yes, that is true. Before 500 BC, religion and poetry were largely the same thing. People did not presume to be able to define the mystery. They looked for words that could describe the mystery. Poetry doesn't claim to be a perfect description, as dogma foolishly does. It's a hint half-guessed, to use T.S. Eliot's phrase. That's why poetry seduces you and entices you into being a searcher for the mystery yourself. It creates the heart leap, the gasp of breath, inspiring you to go further and deeper. You want to fill in the blanks for yourself. Poetry does this by speaking in metaphors. All religious language is metaphor by necessity. It's always pointing toward this mystery that you don't know until you have experienced it. Without the experience, the metaphors largely remain empty. I think this has led to the ineffectiveness of much organized religion. The metaphors religions use are usually true, but we too often defend the words instead of seeking the experience itself. Thomas Merton once said that when you hear Jesus say that you must eat my flesh and drink my blood, you are supposed to stop breathing for a minute. Instead, we just argue about it. The word metaphor comes from the Greek and means to carry across, to carry a meaning across, to carry you across. If you're still living mostly out of the left brain, you think the word has to perfectly define. But the right brain realizes that the better way to describe the moment is through a metaphor indirectly. Probably the most quoted lines from Emily Dickinson are, "Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. The truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind." I'm convinced this is the present impasse with so much of institutional religion, that we have for centuries perfectly defined, delineated, and described the mystery. And all you have to do is believe your denomination's dogmatic definitions, and you are a member in good standing. This isn't working. It isn't transforming people. Carl Jung didn't consider himself an opponent of Christianity, but wanted to be its pastor to re-enliven its life-changing myths and metaphors. He looked at his father and his six uncles, who were all Swiss Reformed pastors, and he knew they were not happy, generative, or in love. For them, it was all just a human commandment, a lesson memorized, as it says in Isaiah 29:13. Carl Jung believed that the course of Jesus' life was the perfect map for the transformative journey, if only people would go inside their own souls. I think poetry gives you resonance more than logical proof, and resonance is much more healing and integrating. It resounds inside of you. It evokes and calls forth a deeper self. That is the power of good poetry and why poetry can work so deeply. When religion becomes mere philosophy, accurate definitions, moralisms about others, rituals and dogmas in the head, that is the beginning of the end of religion as actual transformation. Now no one knows what to do with their pain except project it onto other people. Mary Oliver wrote, "Poetry is a life-cherishing force, for poems are not words after all, but fires for the coal, ropes let down to the lost, something as necessary as bread for the hungry." Mirabai Starr has written, "Poetry is a gateway into unitive consciousness. It knocks on the doors of the heart and the heart opens. Poets speak truth in a very naked way that bypasses the rational mind. Poetry evokes rather than describes." I believe poetry can help us connect with our true self, uninhibited by ego's needs for certitude and security. A good poem can open us up to experience reality and let it shatter the walls that protect our falsity. Kabir was a religious reformer who achieved a remarkable synthesis of Hindu, Muslim, and even Christian belief. He was an artist and musician, and his poems were probably originally songs. Sit with Kabir's metaphors of unitive consciousness. Quote, "All know that the drop merges into the ocean, but few know that the ocean merges into the drop." I'd like to offer you this poem by Rainer Maria Rilke, just to listen to and later read, and let your heart open. "I'm too alone in the world, yet not alone enough to make each hour holy. I'm too small in the world, yet not small enough to be simply in your presence like a thing, just as it is. I want to know my own will and to move with it. And I want, in the hushed moments when the nameless draws near, to be among the wise ones, or alone. I want to mirror your immensity. I want never to be too weak or too old to bear the heavy, lurching image of you. I want to unfold, let no place in me hold itself closed, for where I am closed, I am false. I want to stay clear in your sight. I would describe myself like a landscape I've studied at length in detail, like a word I'm coming to understand, like a picture I pour from at mealtime, like my mother's face, like a ship that carried me when the waters raged. Others have often said that this poem is worth learning in German, just to read it in its original form. Let us take this moment to connect with that gateway into unitive consciousness. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. The practice this week is titled Haiku. In The Cloister Walk, Kathleen Norris writes, "Poets understand that they do not know what they mean, and that is their strength. Writing teaches us to recognize when we have reached the limits of language and our knowing, and are dependent on our senses to know for us." Haiku is a short form of Japanese insight poetry, a simple way of communing with nature. As with writing and reading other poetry, haiku can open the heart and mind to non-dual consciousness and to immediate encounter with presence. Creating haiku requires discipline and conciseness, focusing on just a single moment or movement and a couple juxtaposing elements. A haiku is a little sliver of concentrated reality. There's no room for parenthetical, extraneous material, all the ifs, ands, and buts. You must leave space for the imagination to fill in the gaps. I invite you to try writing a haiku as a way of being intimately present to reality. Don't worry about making a perfect poem or following the rules. Many English haiku poems consist of 17 syllables in 3 phrases of 5, 7, and 5 syllables. But however the words emerge, let the process of creating the poem break you open to a deeper knowing, beyond definition and description, to experience. Find somewhere you can sit undisturbed while paying close attention to something in nature. A flower, tree, sunrise, rock, rain. Observe the object without words or analysis. Experience being there, in this moment, in this space. Listen to the essence of being communicated wordlessly to you. After some time in silence, jot down a few words and phrases. Play with the way the words sound, speaking them aloud, rearranging them, letting go of unnecessary words. Allow the poem to flow from your unmediated encounter of God's presence within nature. Thank you for being with me. May your week be filled with resonance with wisdom, with resonance of your imaginarium. Blessings to all.